that last sentence you just said, once you lock in, this is again like calling back to my episode with Theo, once you lock in what your app should look like, the problem is that never fucking happens. Before we jump into today's conversation, I've got a recommendation. Jonathan Hall, a friend of mine who was on the show 10 or so episodes back, well, he's got his own podcast that you should definitely check out. It's called Cup O' Go, and we do talk a lot about Go development here on this podcast, but we also talk about a lot of other stuff. And Cup O' Go is a great podcast if you really just want to keep going deeper on the Go programming language. So Cup O' Go, go check them out. They're on all the major podcasting platforms and on YouTube. Sean Walker, super excited to have you on the show. We've not yet talked about Ruby or Rails yet on the pod. So super happy that you're here to join me today.
Yeah, I'm glad that I could be the Rails person for this podcast because I represent all of the Rails community. No, I'm just kidding.
You're the biggest name in Rails. Maybe. Why would I even invite DHH when I can get you?
It's true. Yeah. DHH, he really doesn't know too much about Rails, you know? So it makes more sense to have me.
Yeah, he's too far in the weeds on implementation because he made it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
He's not in user space.
Yeah. So true. Ridiculous. So true.
Cool. Okay, so I've known you tangentially on Twitter for a while. We have a lot of mutual friends. Obviously, you stream on Twitch, Ruby, Rails, Rust. You primarily had a career in Ruby on Rails. Let's just start with a simple question of when did you start coding? And then the follow-up of when did you start writing Ruby?
Oh, my gosh. Man, I'm going to like show my age. I guess you can already see my age. But I will say, so I started coding when I was like junior high, I want to say. It's been a while. You know, it was just like side project stuff. But I started coding earnestly probably in like high school because I was kind of dabbling. Like my dad was a programmer kind of, and he had books and I would read the books. It was like C, but then in high school I started doing more like real programming, which is mostly C++.
Just shit on everyone that's not writing C++.
And then so yeah, I started writing Ruby. So this is a funny story. Like this is the context. Okay, it was 2010. Okay, like okay. And Rails was hot. Like it was so hot. Like, yeah. You know, it was like hotter than bun, you know? So at the time I wanted to do Rails so bad. I was doing ASP.NET. What was it? I think it was called Webform. I was doing Webforms. Okay.
Okay.
It was my first like web development job. And I was like, I need to do Rails. Rails is the thing. I want to get into web dev. I want to do Rails. It's so hot. DHH is thought leadering me to do Rails. And so I got my first Rails job finally in 2012, which Rails is still really hot. I think Rails 3 had just come out. Merb was a framework that, so if you don't
Rails
know, Rails
3 was already out in 2012.
Yeah. I think it just came out. I'm pretty sure.
Okay. Do you know what major version they're on now?
They're on 7. Okay. They're on Rails 7.
7. Okay. Yeah. They're moving pretty quick. That's like every 2 years or so, right?
Yeah, there was a lull for a while. Like I think Rails 5 was around for like Rails 4 was around for a long time, and then it was a weird gap between 4 and 5. But yeah, they're on 7 now. But yeah, so I started programming Rails in 2012. It's been a long journey, too long probably, but yeah, that's how long I've been programming Rails. Well, on and off. Like I got another C# job in between, but yeah, mostly 10 years of Rails is what you could say I've been doing.
Got it. Okay, so one of my philosophies around learning to code, like becoming a software engineer, is you should kind of try to become what I call like a T-shaped developer.
Yes.
And the way I describe this, I did not come up with this, by the way, but the way I describe it is basically you want to have like kind of a broad knowledge of a lot of things. to quote Adventure Time, an approximate knowledge of many things, and then kind of like an expertise in like one or two things or something specific, right? So that when you do go apply for a job, you're not just seen as like another jack of all trades, but like you're actually good at that thing. And I think you'll have a, you know, better chance of getting that specific job. But it is important to like be aware of all these different technologies so that like when you show up, even if it is for a Golang backend interview, when someone uses the word Ruby on Rails, you're not just like deer in the headlights. Like you have no idea what it is. Right. So that's why I love doing interviews like this, where like, I don't do Ruby on Rails. I don't teach Ruby on Rails on Boot Dev, but like, I just feel like it's one of those things that a lot of the students do need to at least know about. So let's jump in. So obviously you've been doing Ruby on Rails for a long time. What is Ruby and what is Rails?
this is a good question. So if you don't know like all the history, which it's so funny that I know all this stuff. If you don't know like the history of Ruby or Rails, Ruby is a programming language written in 1995 by a guy named Yukihiro Mats something, but everyone calls him Mats, M-A-T-Z, right?
Okay.
So Mats made Ruby in 95. He wanted to, he's Japanese, but it's beside the point. He wanted to bring joy to programming, right? He wasn't having a good time with C. Yeah. He's an old school C programmer. He wasn't having a good time with C. He's like, I want to make a new language. Ruby was that language. It's supposed to be fun to program in, no static typing, you know, which was at the time, 90s to like mid 2000s, no static typing was trendy.
Right. And so now it's like, now we like make fun of that, but it was like really cool coming from C, right?
Yeah, it was really cool coming from C. So he made Ruby, and it wasn't until 2003, I think, that DHH started to make Rails, but I think he only made it because he was using Ruby to make the first version of what would become Basecamp, which is 37signal's first product.
Yeah.
So Ruby is the programming language. Rails is the framework. So it's like JavaScript is to express JS. That's what it is, right?
Right.
Yeah. So that's the difference.
Although I would, so I'm actually interested to hear your take on this. I sometimes get frustrated when people refer to Express as a framework, and it's just because I'm in camp words mean things,
sure,
versus words don't mean things, which I feel like sometimes we can slip into. And the way I define a framework is basically like you build your app in the framework rather than like injecting the framework into your app. It's like, which is the big one and which is the small ones, right? So like when I use just an authentication library and all it does is authentication, I feel like I'm injecting that into my app, right? My app is the big thing and I'm injecting in some authentication. Whereas like when I think of like Rails, it's like, no. Like this whole thing is Rails and like my application logic fits in like this file where you tell me it should, right? And I put my application logic into it. So I've always kind of viewed Express.js as more just like a routing library than like a fully fledged framework, right? Doesn't really have opinions on databases and authentication, all these sorts of things. Same like with Go, like I'll use a routing library in Go to build a REST server, but I won't necessarily, like I wouldn't really call that a framework. How do you think about that? Just like contrasting the difference between like Express and Rails so that people aren't necessarily thinking they're the same thing.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. I mean, Rails is your app or your Rails calls your app, right? The framework is the thing that calls you and libraries you call, right? And I would say, Express is very minimal and it is more just routing. Rails is more all-encompassing, database, background jobs, email, it's got email, receiving email.
Like you don't Google how to do X in Ruby, like you Google how to do X in Rails, right?
Yeah, exactly. No, that's fair. That's fair. Rails is a framework, Express is more like a library. That's fair. So I don't know if JavaScript might not have, I think sales probably, right? Like JavaScript probably has other more all-encompassing things with the do background jobs and all that stuff, but
well, I just actually stopped recording with Wes Boss like 30 minutes ago, and he was talking about how like one of his main points was like JavaScript doesn't have a Rails yet, so like it's funny that you both like said the exact same thing.
Well, I'm just if there is one, I'm not aware of it, right?
Yeah,
but yeah, I mean most ecosystem don't have, like, they don't have a Rails.
It's kind of like Python Django, right? Like, Django's kind of almost there. It's got its own ORM and some authentication stuff. Yeah, so Laravel has, like, a whole hosting solution. Like, they actually offer, isn't that, like, the business model? They do, like, hosting and essentially cloud infrastructure for you?
I think so. All I know is that the person, his name's Taylor, I forget Otwell. His last name.
Yeah.
Otwell, Taylor Otwell. All I know is he has a Lambo, so clearly there is a business model, you know. I mean, but I will say, like, if Taylor Otwell might have a Lambo, but DHH has a Pagani, so, you know.
Oh, I didn't even know that. He's not famous for it. He's flying under the radar.
Yeah, he is. He's definitely a fan. He has a house in Malibu. Like, the guy's rich.
Okay. So building, there is money to be made in building frameworks if you do it the right way.
Apparently.
Although, I guess DHH, like, Taylor Otwell is focused on Laravel. DHH is actually, like, running a company, right? 37 Signals. I don't think he really, has he, like, other than the publicity of Rails, do you think he's profited off of Rails in any way? Are there even any products surrounding that?
No, I don't think so. He's never done, like, any hosting thing. I mean, he even just recently released Kamal, which is, like, a deploy solution for Rails to Kubernetes. But yeah, I mean, I don't think he's even written a book about it, to tell the truth.
Yeah, I think it's mostly been, like, I mean, obviously it's supporting open source and all those great things, but also just, I know that anyone who uses Rails is probably pretty bought into, like, the 37 Signals Basecamp ecosystem. Like, I worked at a company that was kind of migrating off of Rails and onto Go. This is a few years back. And there was very much like a, you know, we read 37 Signals. We run our company that way. So there's definitely some kind of, like, secondary effects that I'm sure have helped in some way.
Yeah, no, that is true. I mean, like, even people at my company, we don't necessarily appreciate 37 Signals. We don't use Basecamp. We don't use any of that stuff. But we do know of, like, what happens in DHH's, like, universe.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the man publishes a blog post and everyone's reacting to it.
Yeah, that is true. That is true.
In fact, maybe that's where we should go next. So DHH publishes a lot of blog posts, and the recent ones have been, I mean, I guess he's always kind of been a contrarian. And I think it was, I'm now going to kind of, like, quote Dax Rad from the Tomorrow FM podcast, but he was basically saying that he was a contrarian always. But 15 years ago, Dax was basically saying, yeah, he was right. Like, turns out he was right. And it's, I think Dax's take is now that he maybe disagrees with some of the more recent blog posts. So there was recently a blog post by DHH on dynamic typing. And basically the thesis was, hey, dynamic typing's better, actually. And this has kind of been on the back of, you know, TypeScript gaining so much popularity. And I think he famously ripped TypeScript out of, was it Rails? The Rails code base?
No, it was Turbo, his front end, the front end part of Rails, I guess.
Got it. So the, right, because, I mean, Rails is obviously written Ruby.
Rails is written in Ruby. The Turbo was TypeScript, and now it's only JavaScript.
Okay. And Turbo, can you tell me what Turbo is? Like, I'm actually a little bit confused why there's, like, a runtime involved at all.
Right. So, okay, so Rails is, it's just for the back end, right? Like, redirects, static HTTP 1.1, like, just regular old requests, right? And WebSockets and things and whatever, service end events. But there's no, and you just serve up HTML, right? So Turbo is like HTMX, but it does a little bit more.
Oh, like HTMX. In, like, a more, like,
Rails magic way. Yeah.
Got it. And is it, like, out of the box Rails? Like, this isn't a module that you add?
Rails has built-in things to work with it, but it's now in Rails 7.
Okay.
But in Rails 6, it was kind of new still, and you kind of had to bolt it on a little bit. But Rails 7, it's more integrated for sure.
Got it. So, like, if I go spin up a Rails 7 app, kind of the default app, it's actually shipping, like, a JavaScript library to the front end that supposedly gives me some functionality that I care about.
If you choose it, yeah. As Rails new, if you go Rails new, choose Turbo, yeah.
Okay,
yeah, it will.
That's really interesting. Yeah. I didn't even realize that. And is it like HTMX in that, like, it gives you new HTML properties to add to stuff to enhance functionality?
When I say it's like HTMX, I mean, I guess like, it's funny. Like, I mean, coming from like old school web development, right? HTMX, it doesn't give you new attributes.
Okay.
But it gives you the HateOS like hypermedia as like state, application state, that whole thing, right? The whole philosophy, it's similar. But the way Turbo differs from HTMX is that Turbo has what's called, the main feature is Turbo Frames, right?
Okay.
And so it's, imagine if iframes were Ajax, right? That's what Turbo Frames tries to deliver. So you wrap the part of the page you want to change in a Turbo Frame. And then when you submit a form, you click a link, just that bit gets updated and Rails handles all that on the back end.
Got it. So because, let me kind of like run this back. So in like a typical SPA single page application in like sure. React, I would make an Ajax request, an asynchronous fetch request to like a backend service. And I get back JSON. Some JSON, right? And then I'd like use that JSON. My JavaScript would parse the JSON and like dump it into the page, right? Like fill out a table or something. Right. HTMX, and I'm going to have the HTMX guy on. I'm super excited pretty soon to talk about it.
That's
cool. I think, oh man, has he committed? Might have to clip this out. I think he has. Can't remember. No, he did. He did. He's scheduled.
Okay.
But the way HTMX works, as per my understanding, is like instead I can make an HTML form and I can add like a special attribute to it, like in the HTML, at least as far as I'm concerned about HTML. And when I post that form, it gets posted to my backend and my backend actually gives me back the HTML that should go in that form. It like swaps it out.
Yep.
And what you're telling me is Rails Turbo with Turbo Frames is a very similar idea. Obviously it's not HTMX, but like it's not a special tag on like a form, but instead it's like you almost mark a div as swappable.
Yep, that's basically right. So there's a Turbo Frame element that you can add, so it's like Turbo Dash Frame, like literally that's the element. It's just a div, but they call it like a Turbo Frame. It's like a custom element. It looks like a custom element. And you just wrap whatever you want to change that, like, so inside, then you wrap your form in the Turbo Frame, and then that will, whatever's in the Turbo Frame that matches IDs,
yeah,
those will change inside that frame.
Okay, so let's talk about this philosophy for a second. This is something that I think will be really useful to a lot of my listeners. So web development for the last 6 years, there's been a lot of this just JSON-based data web development. What I mean is like you build your backend, it's built in any old language you want. It's probably a REST API. You've got a front end that's essentially an application that's a mashup of HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, right? There might be a view in there. There might be an Astro or a React or whatever. But that application just communicates with some backend REST server using JSON. So it's like data only. In other words, the backend server in this architecture model doesn't give a shit about what your front end looks like. Like it doesn't care that you have a div there. It doesn't care that you have a form there. It doesn't care about the colors. And that's pretty nice. Like as a backend developer, all you have to do is worry about the data. Whereas under this like HTMX, Turbo Frames or like old school PHP, the backend drove like how the front end looked. What are your thoughts just on that architecture? Does it make sense? When does it make sense?
It does make sense. And it's like that meme, you know, where it was like, you know, I think Prime, he shared it or whatever. It's like from that Tom Hanks movie where it's like pirates take over the ship. And the guy's like, you're full stack now. And the guy's like a backend. So like, that's how it was.
Yeah.
I mean, like I'm still considered like full stack, even though like I wouldn't say I'm like the best designer in the world, but I do work from when I say full stack, I mean I work from like background jobs in Ruby all the way to like I do like Tailwind stuff.
Yeah.
In the browser.
Tailwind, right? CSS, like
that's,
right?
That's full. Yeah, yeah. So that's like, that to me is like, okay, you're full stack, right? You're talking about ingesting data from AWS and you're also like writing CSS like
right.
the same day, right? So like I think it's fair to say that's full stack. Obviously I'm not doing a lot of I have done a little DevOps at my company, but yes, I do think it makes sense from a company's perspective. It makes sense because you can save a lot of money, right?
Like right.
you get one of me in there instead of like two people, you're saving a lot of money, right? Do I think it makes sense from a product perspective? It depends on the product. Like if it's B2B SaaS admin dashboards, it makes perfect sense, right? Like they don't really do too much. They show some tables, they show some charts. You see some ingested data.
Just like CRUD, basic CRUD.
You might have data entry. Yeah, you might have CRUD. There's not a lot going on. So from that perspective, yes, HTMX, the HateOS model makes perfect sense. And I think React is largely overkill for that type of application. But for something like a social network, I mean, React's probably the right way to go.
Yeah, when there's like so much complexity on a page.
And there's a mobile app and there's like other things. Yeah.
Yeah. In my mind, and I may be totally off here because I frankly haven't worked with HTMX yet and I need to. It seems to me like it would be more useful in more of like what I would consider a website. And yeah, I could see how like even a simple kind of CRUD app might fall into this category as well. But the minute it starts to feel more like an application with like lots of stateful logic on the front end, I could see why it would start to be really hard.
Yes. Not to mention like latency, like network latency is a problem, right? You click a button, you're still waiting for the network.
Right, yeah. Right. You can't do the fancy client-side rendering tricks under this this new model.
Yep.
New model. It's the old model.
Right? It's the old model. Yeah.
It's the exactly it's the old way of doing the web. Yeah. Super interesting.
Yeah.
DHH has published some controversial stuff. Dynamic types. As a Ruby developer, obviously dynamic typing is a thing. Same with Python. So a lot of my listeners have done plenty of Python. How do you feel about his takes on dynamic types?
I mean, software dev is cyclical, you know? Like, I mean, at the time, dynamic types were hot years ago. Static types are now hot. Do I think dynamic types will ever be hot again? It's possible. Look, I don't want to say, okay? Like, it's possible. But I do think, like, in terms of TypeScript, I don't know how much benefit there is over regular JavaScript. Only because TypeScript
is... Ooh, this is spicy. I'll be sure to publish this video right after Theo's video.
Yeah, only because TypeScript, it's Java. It's still JavaScript, right? And so like papering over, it feels like you're papering over some of JavaScript's like problems, but you're not quite there. So, I mean, from that perspective, I think he's probably in the right in this one. But if it was a real type language like Go or Rust or something, no, like that's way better. Don't rip out types for that. But for JavaScript and TypeScript, like it's not enough of a benefit, I would say.
Okay, this is some hot banter we're about to have. I'm really excited. I had Michael Green on 8 episodes ago to fight the dynamic typing fight, but from a Python perspective. But his perspective was actually just the dynamic types are better, or at least in a majority of cases.
All right.
Whereas what you're saying is, JavaScript might be better than TypeScript, but also you're a Rust fan, and I don't know, are you a Go fan?
Not really.
All right, well, wrong again, but we can table that. But you're at least a Rust fan, which obviously has very strong static types.
It does.
And you like that. So
I do.
Seems like some cognitive dissonance there, Sean. tell me why.
It does. I mean, like TypeScript. Well, first of all, it still has nulls, right? There are no option generics, which is like one of the major, I think, things that static typing should give you. Strong static typing should give you option generics. Just Go does not have that either. Go still has nulls, right? And results.
Hey, they're nils.
Also... yeah, okay.
You spell it with three letters. Yeah.
I mean, they're in nils in Ruby too, but yeah. So it's like, I don't think TypeScript is enough to justify like the added complexity, the build step, right?
Right. So like the overhead of the compile step, the verbose syntax, like you see the static typing as a benefit, just not as enough of a benefit.
In TypeScript specifically. Yeah.
In TypeScript specifically. Right. Yeah. But in Rust,
In Rust, it's worth it.
Pet language.
It's totally worth it.
It's fine.
It's not my pet language. Yeah. No, I think for a lot of applications, dynamic typing is fine, right? I'm talking about smaller, sort of, all very simple applications. Dynamic typing, static typing is not going to help you that much. But for something like ETLs that can be complicated, or other things that what you said before, situated or single page things, TypeScript might actually have some benefit. But the types of apps that DHH writes for types, TypeScript does not help him, right? Because the stuff that he does the screens aren't that complex, right?
So let me ask a question about this, because I don't know if I'm buying it. And here's why. So you're writing some Ruby,
yeah,
and you've got some data model, and now you need to use that data model on the front end in your JavaScript, or do you not? Maybe that's the difference. When you're writing Ruby, are you ever parsing these objects into your JavaScript code, or are you just rendering the HTML with
Ruby?
You're
just rendering the HTML with Ruby. Yeah.
So yeah, I guess I can see that. Does your tooling stop you from using properties that don't exist in any way, or do you just have to kind of know? Okay, what does that look like, and how does that work without a static type system?
So Ruby there's linting, right? And that's what TypeScript is a linter, right?
Yeah,
And so we have linters in Ruby, and we've also got Shopify's working on LSP for Ruby, but Solargraph is the main linter, and it will check to see that your active record models don't have this column in the database, so you cannot call that, right? That's what you're saying.
Got it. Yeah, because in Ruby, a property is essentially a getter, right?
Right.
It can be, it's a method that can be overwritten.
Yeah, that is correct.
And so you're saying your tooling is sophisticated enough that you can tell if a getter exists or not.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, that, ta-da! That's 95% of TypeScript. Right. The benefit of TypeScript, in my opinion. Of static types in general.
Right.
So that makes perfect sense to me. But so have you ever written a RESTful Ruby service?
I've written REST APIs, but I haven't written a REST API that gets consumed by a SPA person.
Got it.
Yeah,
got it.
In Rails. I haven't done that in Rails personally, but I've done it inside projects and other things. And in C#, I did do C# on the back end, React on the front end, but that's, again, static typed, so.
Yeah, because that to me is where the majority of the pain lies in I'm gonna parse some JSON, and even if it's just even if it's one single key, just the fact that I could typo it and nothing's gonna yell at me is that's all the pain in the world to me.
There's a lot of people Michael Green apparently is a dynamic typing apologist, and then you've got Rich Hickey, right, who's famously was a C++ programmer, wrote Clojure, right? That's dynamic typed. And he disagrees. He's very into dynamic typing. He doesn't see the benefit of static typing. So yeah, with a strong linter, I think it's probably okay for most apps, but mission critical things, I would probably rather fly in a plane that doesn't have Ruby on board and it does have something like C++ or Rust, but that's just personal opinion.
Oh yeah, it's not even close for me. And please, don't allow web developers to write that code. We're just not rigorous enough in our craft, be writing that kind of software.
Yeah,
I think this is another this is a Rob Walling quote from an earlier episode, but basically agile development, really great for the web, should probably be doing it. It's going to increase productivity, have better business outcomes, but also probably shouldn't be shipping to production 10 times a day, when you're working on MRI software or something that could imagine the software that drives the LASIK surgery machine. You're just shipping updates to prod over Wi-Fi. That sounds like an absolute disaster.
Yeah, if that was Ruby or JavaScript, no thank you. I'll stick with contacts. Thank you very much.
Okay, cool. So, all right. I definitely understand your position. And I tend to agree. Honestly, it sounds like you're not actually using that much JavaScript in your Rails apps, at all.
That's true. It's true. I mean, look, at work, we're still on jQuery, so, you know, it's just the kind of world I live in, you know?
Yeah, very, very different. Okay, cool. That, like, again, such important context to have, especially if you're a new developer, you're learning about all this stuff. It's so easy to, like, watch a video and think this way of building apps is the only way, when in reality, there's, like, maybe three or four, like, serious, like, big picture architectures that are used today. And then of those, there's even subsets of, like, different ways you can break stuff out. And every company I've worked at has had its own, like, own mess of architecture. It's always a mess.
That is the truth. I mean, it is always a mess. Like, there's never any, like, oh, I walked into this clean architecture. Like, that's perfect. Like, I wish I could do this, you know, all the time. No.
Yeah, it's, and always, there's always, like, something. Some migration underway. Like, we're always in the middle of moving to something.
Yeah, I mean, even now, like, so GitHub made this library called Vue Components. And if you're not in the Rails or Ruby world, you wouldn't even know what this is. But essentially, Rails, the biggest problem with Rails is that it only has what's called partials, right? And so they're kind of like components, but very slow and horrible. So GitHub saw this, and GitHub famously, right, written in Rails.
Yeah.
And so they wrote a library called Vue Component, and this is, it encapsulates, it basically marries a Ruby class to a bit of HTML. And so it's like more, it's like strongly sort of married together. Whereas partials, you can just throw a hash in there. A hash means like a hash map or like a dictionary. I don't know what you call that. Yeah. So like, then you just throw that in there and you can start rendering things. But in Vue Components, it's very explicit, whereas partials are very, like, sort of in not really explicit.
Yeah, the difference between, like, just handing it a string and hoping it maps to something,
right?
And, like, having not a keyword, but, like, a token in your abstract syntax tree that resolves to something, I'm guessing, so that's tooling will tell you.
Yeah, yep, Vue Component, yeah. So, yeah, we're in that migration. There's always a migration. You're totally right.
What do you think about DHH's migration off the cloud? Is this something you agree with?
Oh, that was a great segue. Oh my goodness. If I could just do that on my streams. Okay, so that was amazing. Yeah, DHH moving out the cloud. I reread that post. His like famous, it was actually months ago that he talked about moving out the cloud. He just recently like talked about it again and how he saved the company saved $1 million, right?
Right.
Every year they're saving $1 million. But the old post makes it, it puts it in context, right? So they have multiple old legacy applications that they do not update anymore, except for security updates. And they're, if you didn't
know, it's like making money, just running in the background.
Exactly. It's making money, but they don't touch it, right? Basically, except for security. So from that perspective, the cloud is costing them a lot of money because they're not selling it, right? There's no new users. It's just the existing users. They're just maintaining. And they have like five of those. They like, I think like, I forget the names of them, but they're like, one's a to-do list, one's like a chat thing. There's like a bunch of them, right? And so from that perspective and the perspective of 37 Signals, which is we will run these apps until the end of the internet, right? That was their famous marketing thing. From that perspective, it makes perfect sense to move the majority of your stuff off of the cloud. And since they are already in the process of over-provisioning these servers and doing all this stuff, they might as well just move the rest of it, right?
Yeah.
And I think for 37 Signals specifically, it made sense with that in the context of that post, because they're not a high growth company anymore, right? I mean, it sounds sad, but like that's just they've never really been that way.
Yeah, they've always been like the bootstrapped, right. Like trying to grow responsibly, profitably, exactly. Very different than like your Silicon Valley tech startup, right?
Yep. So from that perspective, like it makes sense for them to move off the cloud. But even in the post, DHH goes, well, it doesn't make sense for small companies that are like just getting started because you realistically, I don't know how true this is, but like, I mean, you're probably not going to make it, right? Like you have a startup, you start a startup today.
Yeah.
I mean, odds are you're not going to make it. So like, do you want to have a bunch of colo to date hardware in a data center somewhere in 24 months? Or do you just want to be like, well, we'll just cancel all the cloud subscriptions, whatever, who cares?
Yeah. Okay. This is starting to make a little more sense. I will say, so first of all, I don't have an opinion on whether it was right for them to move off the cloud because I don't fucking know. Like I don't have any of the information required to make that sort of a judgment call. I will say that I don't feel like I've ever worked at or seen a company where it was obvious to me they should move off of the cloud, with the exception of like giant companies that own their own clouds. Like, obviously, right. Google is going to use its own cloud infrastructure. And like, you do get to a point where it just makes sense to build your own cloud if you have that expertise. Like Apple, I feel like it would make more sense for them to build their own cloud offering probably than to like go pay money to Microsoft to rent hardware.
Right.
So there's that aspect to it. But what you said about they have old software that theoretically has like dependency lock-in. Like they're not upgrading Rails versions anymore. They're not upgrading, you know, database versions. They've like locked in all their dependencies. So in theory, you take a snapshot of whatever's working now, and it will continue to work as long as whatever hardware it's running on is compatible with it. And so like taking that hardware and just going and buying it, like shoving it somewhere that's connected to the internet, I can see that. Because to me, one of the big headaches of on-prem is when you do inevitably have to go about upgrading stuff. And like a lot of the cloud services take care of that for you.
Right. Yeah. You just pay your monthly bill and then suddenly your hardware gets faster. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the second thing you said about like, this is like a business term, CapEx versus OpEx, right? Capital expenditure versus operating expenditure. Most companies, especially in the early days, would rather have operating expenditures of like, I'm going to pay $50 a month every month, because if my company fails in 6 months, or if it turned out we made the wrong decision, we can just cancel that bill and like move on. Whereas capital expenditure would be like, okay, we're going to buy, you know, a server rack for $50,000, and we're going to get a dedicated line of fiber and run it to it. And we're like done paying for it, at least for the foreseeable future. So there's no ongoing costs. We've like invested in it. And that, again, that makes sense in their scenario. It's like, we know we have all these customers, they're paying for it. We've got to run this thing till the end of the internet.
Yep.
Versus my startup that might go under in 2 months.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, in the post, it makes more sense. I mean, on Twitter, it makes less sense, right? Because all you see is DHH going, we moved off the cloud. And like, that's it. That's the whole thing. Like, you might link to the post, but then no one reads it. So it's like, what are you talking about, DHH? Like, this is crazy. And I think he suggested too, like, that people look into their own companies and ask if the cloud is right for them. And I think that's where the drama happened, right? It was like, oh, well, he's not saying he's moving off. He's saying maybe we should move off the cloud. That's crazy. Like, let's not do that. And I do think like for in the way he framed the post, it made sense. But I think he even says like for small companies, don't do it. But for larger companies or like even mid-sized companies that sort of have, I don't want to say growth has plateaued, but it's linear. It's not like explosive or it's not like, like spotty. It's like, oh, this month we're doing great, and the next month it's like, really, we're doing terrible. Let's spin some stuff down. Like that's not 37 Signals. And like, I think a lot of B2B SaaS, like, it's very long sales cycles. You're waiting on other contacts at other companies to make these deals happen. In that perspective, I don't know, but I think it might make sense for more companies than just 37 Signals.
Yeah, that's where I definitely start to at least disagree in principle. I think there's got to be so few companies out there that it makes sense for. I mean, you can look. Yeah. I feel like you'll probably be wasting your time. By the way, I want to just really quickly like give a definition of cloud, especially for some of my newer listeners. So like, sure. When we say cloud, we're really comparing it against hosting your own websites like on premise in your office. So like, right. Rewind 25 years and companies had like a computer, a they server did. Sitting yep. in a closet that's like got a dedicated line to the internet, and they've connected their DNS records, right, their domain name, like to their IP address of that computer in the closet, and it's serving all the traffic to the website.
Yeah.
Whereas like nowadays, it's convenient for most companies to rent a server in a data center that's hosted on quote unquote the cloud, which is really just, you know, a data center owned by Amazon in AWS, Google in GCP, Microsoft in Azure, whatever. And then like, they give you like a dynamic IP right. address that you map to DNS. But like the point is, most of the infrastructure is abstracted away from you, and you don't have to like hire people that can run network cables.
I mean, there is a third thing that I think we get, it got lost, right? It's not like there, the third thing is what 37 Signals does is they use a company called Delft, right? Or Deft, I forget. And it's a colo company, right? So they don't ever see the machines, right? The colo companies in the data, they have their own data centers. They're in the data, like Rackspace is another famous one. And they handle all the provisioning and all that stuff. And 37 Signals just pays them money to do that. But 37 Signals does own the machines, right?
Right.
But the maintenance of the machines is outsourced to Rackspace or like Deft or whatever. So yeah, there's this co-location. It's like a spectrum. There's in the closet, co-location, cloud, right? That's like the spectrum of hosting options that you have pretty much. And there's VPSs and stuff, but that's still like cloud, you know?
Yeah, I'm really glad you pointed that out. There's more than just the two options. And yeah, co-location is interesting. It essentially gives you like a lot of the features of this like CapEx versus OpEx scenario. So like you can do the capital expenditure thing, but you are paying for like infrastructure level services. So like you don't need to have the IT people on staff.
Right.
But then the other thing you're definitely missing out on, at least these days, now that the cloud platforms have gotten as sophisticated as they have, is like the software maintenance side. So like when you're working in AWS, for example, and you use like RDS for a database, it's a managed database, right? It installs Postgres for you. It gives you an endpoint you can hit to connect to it. Whereas like the software side of things in a colo, I believe, is still usually kind of just on you.
It is, yeah. And that's, I mean, AWS has some killer features. Like AWS Athena is amazing. Firehose, incredible. I think the cloud makes a lot of sense for a lot of people. And I don't want to take away from that. Like, I mean, I if I started a startup today, I'd probably be on AWS. Like that's just how it is, right? Like, I mean, you know, I mean, I think anyone who's starting today would probably be on AWS. It doesn't make any sense to colo today.
Yeah. And that's kind of what I'm trying to say. I feel like it's so few and far between where it makes sense to try to bring that expertise in-house. Like last company I was at, 600 people, roughly 115 developers. Big company, been around for like 12, 13 years, at least with the current iteration of the product. I don't see any benefit to moving off the cloud in terms of like, yeah, the cloud bill was fairly expensive, but not compared to salaries.
Right.
when you're employing 115 developers, like that's a lot of cash.
Yeah, it
right?
is.
Yeah. So that like the cloud costs were dwarfed by salaries. Right. And so it's just, you know, the headache of like not being able to use managed services anymore and getting 115 people now to like SSH onto boxes to do things, like I can't like it just feels like so far removed in terms of where that calculation
is. I actually agree. I think it is a very niche thing that 37 Signals is doing. And I think I agree with you. There's only a few companies out there that it even makes sense for, like cost wise.
I need to get DHH on the pod to talk about it.
That would be incredible. Like if you had DHH on here, that would be next level. I would definitely tune in for that one.
Yeah, I'll try. I have to make the pod bigger, so that's like episode 100 sort of material, but we're getting there.
There you go.
Okay, cool. Let's talk just a little bit more about Ruby and Rails and this whole ecosystem. I want to hear, what's your least favorite part of the whole Ruby Rails ecosystem?
Okay, so I mean, that's a big one. I mean, Ruby, can I split it up? Ruby and then Rails too? Like, can I?
Oh,
split?
Yeah, that's okay, a good.
Right. So my least favorite part of Ruby is monkey patching, right? It's dynamic, it's runtime changing of classes out from under you, right?
That's disgusting.
So I mean, as a courtesy, no one actually does that. Like when you work at like a professional Rails, no one really monkey patch. If a monkey patch goes to code review, it's going to get denied. Right?
It's like taboo. Okay.
Yeah, it's like taboo. But of course, Rails has it built in, right? There's a whole library called Active Support. And Active Support overrides integers. It adds methods to integers. It adds methods to strings. It adds methods to everything, all at runtime. That's my least favorite part of Ruby is monkey patching. My least favorite part of Rails is probably the partials again. Like the partials, not great. Like it's not a good experience. It's not explicit enough. It's just they're not good. The Vue part of Rails is like really anemic, and it feels like it hasn't changed in 10 years, right? It's the same as it was. And I like that they're trying to do something with Turbo, but it's still built on partials and it's still not a good component story, right?
Yeah.
So that's my least favorite part of Rails. That's been my other least favorite part of Ruby. Those are least favorite.
This whole monkey patching business is interesting to me. I want to make sure I understand it properly really quick. So is it like the global... So like you're saying when I monkey patch something, I'm like changing... Like what's the difference between a monkey patch and like just at like overriding like a parent class's behavior?
Okay, so overriding parent class behavior, the difference is that you could monkey patch like integers, right? You can monkey patch floating point number. You can monkey patch the types of the thing.
So like primitives.
Primitives. You can monkey patch primitives, but also it is class like, okay, so in Rails, you have a Rails console. It's like a REPL, right? And you open up the Rails console in production, you can overwrite a class on that instance, and
next time it's called, it'll I get it. So like you exactly. Hop in and like add debugging.
You can
stuff.
Add methods. You can change methods that were there before, rerun them in the same background job, and they'll run perfectly smooth. Like you know, so it is a double edged sword, right? Because I use it every day, and I made a mistake, and it you know, and I know what the fix is, and like code review is going to be slow. We can solve it for this customer right now, right?
What, Sean? Why have a code review?
Look, code review passed, okay, but you know we still got problems, so it's all right. Look, I haven't really done it that much lately, but I will say that I do succumb to it. All right, I'm sorry.
No, that's amazing. I would always laugh because like this company I worked at had this like really intense approval process to get changes out to production. But everyone in the company kind of just knew that like you'd go through this, they would do releases every 2 weeks, something I don't advise in web. I feel like you should be deploying often, but
yes.
They'd release every 2 weeks. There'd be like a bunch of QA, like manual review, everything goes out because it's like thousands of files change because you've got, you know, lots of developers all making changes over a 2 week period and pushing to production.
Right.
Stuff breaks. And then for the next week, everyone's just doing hot fixes that like don't have to be approved. So like it's just like push something that's completely broken and then just like hot patch it for like a week.
Look, I mean, that honestly, that's the state of the industry. Like I was talking to my old coworker who's like C# guy. He's like, he was depressed. He's like, oh man, like, I wish web was like a little more like rigorous. You know, I just wish we could just do a little more. And I agree. I wish that we just were a little more like less focused on like the agile, like, oh, let's just business. Let's seal this deal with this company. Like, let's just get it out there. But I mean, you know,
I feel like we lack the proper philosophy because like, I think it's, and I would guess you'd agree, like Waterfall wasn't great.
No,
I wouldn't go back there, but like, I don't think, first of all, agile is like such a vague term in the first place, but like even if you like harden it a little bit and like talk about Scrum, like I have a lot of problems with Scrum, but I don't feel like we found the better philosophy yet.
I mean, agile, you're the one who was stickler about words. So like agile, I mean, you know, that's a word that doesn't mean anything anymore.
Oh yeah. You go read the Agile Manifesto, it says a bunch of great things, but like, it's not what the LinkedIn influencers are talking about, generally speaking.
It's true. It's true.
Oh, man. Okay. So I got your least favorite opinions. Now I want to hear what your most, like, what your favorite thing is, but, like, make it unpopular. You know what I mean? Like, what do you like that, like, not everybody likes? And this, you can go broad if you need to. This doesn't just have to be like Rails and Ruby, but like just engineering. Like, what unpopular opinion do you have that you're pretty confident about?
Let's see. I mean, I guess like it relates to Ruby in a certain way, but because I mean, Ruby has, not only does it have monkey patching, the way monkey patching works is a dynamic dispatch, right? So what I mean by dynamic dispatch is there's a special method called, if you have a class, right, called A, and you have a then you can say, okay, you can define a method called method missing. And when you call a dot a, and if a does not exist, method missing gets called instead, right?
Oh, so it's like a default. It's like the default statement in a switch case.
Exactly.
Yeah, like the case doesn't exist. Yeah, we're going to exactly. go do this. Yep,
but it's
thing.
For okay. fields on classes, right? Or it's for methods on classes.
Methods on classes. Got it. Yeah.
So methods on instances of classes. So it's kind of like Mac. It's like reverse macros, right? It's like you can do things dynamically when something doesn't exist, right? So macros are another thing, right? It's like the opposite, right? You can like define things that will exist once the compiler gets done, but they don't right. exist now when you're writing the code. So my unpopular opinion is probably that macros were always the right thing to do. They're the correct abstraction in most cases. Go doesn't have macros, right? Mm-mm. But like I'm a big Lisp fan too. Obviously, there's a lot of overlap between Ruby and Lisp. They say Ruby is an acceptable Lisp, right? And I agree. I mean, as a Lisp person, I agree. I think Lisp has much more powerful with its macros. But Ruby has method missing, and it has dot send, which is like the other side of it, where you can like send things as strings, and like they become the functions that are defined on the methods. It's really weird. But so,
help me understand just really quick why is method missing similar to macros? I'm not making that connection.
No, I'm saying like method missing is you can do things that don't exist when you're writing the code, right?
Okay.
So when the code gets called, stuff that didn't exist will now exist, right? So it's like the opposite of macros, but it's like the other side of the coin, right?
Okay, I see what you're saying. It's like it never came to exist, therefore do this other thing. So it's almost it's almost the opposite, I guess.
Yeah. So but my unpopular opinion is that stuff like that, not necessarily at runtime, but macros specifically for static typing, and like in Rust proc macros, for example.
Yeah.
That's the correct abstraction in a lot of cases. Paul Graham famously, like, he wrote this thing about how he thought in the future, right, like now, 2023, we would all be writing macros, and he didn't envision NPM or like Cargo or whatever Go does, right? He didn't envision all this stuff. Like, he just thought we'd all be writing macros and all our code would be generated all the time because he was a Lisp person, right?
Yeah.
And I tend to agree. Like, there's a lot of problems, like shipping all these binaries or shipping all this source everywhere. Because all these supply chain attacks, right? That's a real thing. I know it doesn't really affect people day to day because we all use the same popular packages. But if you venture out into the NPM ecosystem and you mistype something,
don't
right?
venture.
There's gonna be. I mean, you're gonna get a Bitcoin miner on your computer. You know,
yeah.
It's gonna happen. So from that perspective, I do think macros are more powerful, and they can be more powerful because one programmer can now do the work of like a bunch of programmers, right? Like once you lock in what your app will look like, you can like macro it up, right? And you can take that macro with you to the next project.
That's the crux, is that last sentence you just said. Once you lock in, this is again like calling back to my episode with Theo. Once you lock in what your app should look like, the problem is that never fucking happens. Like, your product manager is banging on your door six times a day to tell you it's something else.
That is true. But there are parts, right? Like Rails extracted famously the MVC pattern, right? Like it does feel more like this is how all CRUD apps should be, right? That's Rails's killer feature, is that think about resource way of thinking. It's like, instead of thinking about routes and like hooking them up to actions and like thinking about your REST API as resources instead, right? Everything's centered on the database table and you do actions on that. And if it goes outside of the RESTful way of thinking or the resource way of thinking, make more resources, right?
Yeah.
You just want more controllers, right? There are parts that you can abstract. And I think those are like the macro heavy things that you want to do, right?
Yeah. I'm super glad you said this, because I ask my guests for unpopular opinions, and sometimes I just get a popular opinion that's masquerading as an unpopular opinion. I don't even know if this is unpopular, to be honest. I didn't really have an opinion on it until you started talking about it.
It's
now
just unpopular.
I feel one forming in the back of my mind.
It's just unpopular, that's all.
So macros... I want to just like really quickly define them so that everyone listening can really understand. Like in Go, we have code generation.
Yeah, right? That's what I'm. Yeah, I mean it's almost the same. Almost.
Yeah. So like in Go, I would you can use either like the built-in Go generate, which will take some comments and generate a bunch of Go code that does a thing. What's the difference between that and a macro?
So the difference is that the macro operates on the syntax at compile time or before compile time, right? Or like before runtime, I guess. Like, so
it's part of the syntax of the language.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So like Rust proc macros are a good example. When you call derive on a struct, that's a macro, right? And it is code generation, but it doesn't live in your source tree, right? Go,
right.
Go source that gets generated into a file, and Rails too. Rails does this too. Rails G, when you generate Rails code, it lives there in the,
yeah,
you
have to, I check, yeah, it in there. To, yeah, get, yep.
Yep. Yep. So that's the difference, I think. The main difference between a macro and code generation. Macro is code generation, but it doesn't get checked into source, right?
Cool. And then one last question. I just want to make sure, again, for a lot of my audience that are not familiar with macros, why would you ever use a macro to like expand into more code instead of just like making a function? Like, isn't that the purpose of a function, just to call it and have it call some other piece of code? Why would I actually want to like take a macro and generate new code with it and shove that code into my application?
I think there's two reasons. One is like, there's no cost, right? Or there's less cost, right? It's because the macro can generate the functions that will get called, or it can actually do things at compile time. If you have enough information, it can do things at compile time that like it can generate all the, like, let's say your function is going to generate a string. You can just generate that at compile time and have it just sitting there as a constant string, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's one thing. The other thing is you would use the macro I actually forgot what I was going to say, but that was the main thing, right?
Yeah. That makes a ton of sense. Yeah. In Go, you can have like computed constants, but they only work if the only inputs to the computed constants are themselves constants that were like generated before runtime.
Yeah.
Right. So like I could have like a constant that's like age 30, right? And then like days in year 365. And then I could have like the third constant be age in days and do age multiplied by, you know, days in year and get like this computed thing that I don't have to like manually type in as a magic number.
Right.
It sounds like macros are just like a way more powerful version of that, because I'm not just like operating with like primitives that I kind of typed into the constant field at the top of the file.
Yes. And macros can also transform, like, so in Rust, you can have a proc macro that looks like HTML. Like Leptos is famous for this, right? Like you're in Rust, a Rust file still, but it looks like HTML. You just open up HTML, bang, and then a little curly brace. All of a sudden you can start writing HTML and it's perfectly valid Rust, right? Because the macro will convert that HTML at compile time to a bunch of format strings, right? And like,
oh yeah,
yes, yes. So it'll
generate, so you're writing a template.
You're writing a template in Rust
that the macro system will actually break down into like
Rust
functions that then would maybe pass in some dynamic values at runtime.
Yes. So you can make new syntax, right? So that's probably the second thing, is you can make new syntax and it's valid, right? That's like the killer feature of so now you
that sounds awful. That second way you put it sounds terrible. The first way you put it sounded great, and then you said you can invent syntax, and I was like, this sounds terrible. It sounds like monkey patching.
Yeah, maybe that was my unpopular opinion, right?
That was the unpopular part.
That's what it was. Yeah, but I do think the whole like separation of files is weird, right? Like we only do it because our editors they suck, right? Like we have HTML source, then we have JavaScript source, and then we've got Ruby or Go or whatever. Right. And we all keep them in separate different files only because we're forced to. Right. So JSX with React showed us the right way. Right. Which is shove it all together. Right. I want my CSS and my JavaScript like spell. I want it to be all in the same. Don't even separate with tags. I just want like a proc macro that separates, like it has CSS and Rust. It's got HTML. It's got everything all in the same file. That's my number one unpopular opinion, probably.
We found the unpopular one. This is I'm glad we dug in, because we definitely got it. That's great. Thank you so much for coming on, Sean. This has actually been really fun. Even though we talked about Ruby, a language that I tend to not do anything with.
You're not alone. Don't worry.
I think it was a great, great piece of educational material. Where can people find you? Like what you're doing online, that sort of thing.
Yeah, so I'm at twitch.tv/SWLKR. It was cool. Okay, this is another thing. It was cool back in the day to not have vowels in your name. So look, I'm sorry, okay? I'm sorry. No one knows how to pronounce it.
Your handle is like a startup from 2012.
I know. And now it's too late, right? It's too late to change. So I'm also at Twitter, the same thing, @Walker. So yeah.
Fantastic. Go follow Sean, Twitter, Twitch, Zitter. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. Right. Forgot. Oh.
Cool. Yeah, thanks so much for coming on, man. We'll talk to you later.